This is the Friends of History Debating Society. I am Gaius, John Batchelor, and Germanicus, Marco Vallejos, is here. We're in Londinium, it's 90 AD, and it's a week since we spoke at length philosophically about the conduct of our empire, the Roman Empire, the might of Rome, and we're very happy living at the edge of the empire here in Londinium, prosperous, surrounded by retired centurions, very far from Rome, not caught up in the backstabbing that is routine. Our emperor Domitian was campaigning on the Danube. He's back in Rome now, enjoying the praise of his victories against the savages, the barbarians in the Danube River Valley. However, this moment here in Londinium gives us an opportunity to reflect not only on how our empire is doing in the first century AD, and it will have a very good second century, and then reflect on our empire and reflect on the American empire in the 21st century. The fact of the matter is the American empire is now engaged one more time in a land war in Asia and Eurasia. A land war in Eurasia is something that is commonplace for the last several centuries. And the empires in Eurasia have been struggling with each other at least since the beginning of the 20th century. We can go back farther than that, but that's enough. These empires, the Romanov, the Hohenzollern, the Habsburg, the British Empire, the French Republic, these empires have been struggling, and America shows up. So we first look not at the whole story, but at an incident that's taken place in these last hours in the American empire struggle with the land war in Eurasia. The president of the United States, Joe Biden, an experienced political voice, near 50 years of speaking on foreign affairs as a senator, as chairman of important committees such as the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, the president speaking overseas about the conflict in Ukraine said of Vladimir Putin, the president of the Russian Federation that launched the attack, the president said, for God's sake, this man cannot remain in power. He said that in Warsaw. Immediately was interpreted in London as the order of regime change. That's the polite way of saying decapitation. And so I welcome Germanicus to comment on our experience here in the Roman Empire about decapitation. Germanicus, it's wonderful to have an opportunity to reflect on the divine Caesar, who, after all, authored the background that inherited by Octavian, now Augustus, that gave us this magnificent empire here in the first century AD, and we enjoy the fruits here in Londinium. But decapitation was practiced by Caesar with Vercingetorix, the leader of the Gallic faction, and it's something that was practiced again in the Civil War. In other words, you don't defeat the army, you get the man, you get the leader, whether it's Pompey or Caesar or others. And decapitation has some success if you look at the Roman Empire and how it was constructed. We meet in battle and you defeat the enemy king and you win. But what have we learned here in the Roman Empire about decapitation that makes it not wise to pursue this in a conflict in the Eurasian continent? Our part of the Eurasian continent is the Middle Sea, the Mediterranean, but the whole vast continent in the 21st century. Good evening to you, Germanicus.
Good evening, Gaius. The de capito, or off with his head, as I guess the Red Queen would say in Alice in Wonderland, is a critical ritual and symbolic act in which the very public and ceremonial death inflicted upon an enemy leader not only signals to the defeated people that they have no recourse but submission, but it also, by the cutting off of the head, in a strange way, transfers the legitimacy to rule from the leader that is decapitated to the new leader. And thus it becomes a kind of succession ritual, a kind of transfer of power in the superficial American coinage. And this is something that is renowned in the ancient world, and especially so when the leader is a charismatic rallying point or lightning rod for his people, and where the leader becomes the representative of the collective person of the society almost. And so this explains why Alexander, for example, after the final defeat of the Persian Empire at the Gaugamela, pursued Darius to the end, and his death set into play a complete acceptance of Hellenistic rule over the giant Persian world empire. In the same manner, it was felt critical for the Roman Senate to pursue Hannibal and to kill him so that Carthage would be completely submissive to Rome, which it was. That wasn't enough. They still had to destroy it anyway. But the fact is that the De Capito is seen in circumstances, especially when the leader has that kind of ritual and symbolic positioning in the hearts and minds of a society, that is the way ahead. And so there was a tremendous desire to, say, get rid of Hitler for that reason. And the Operation Valkyrie was seen as a way to end the Third Reich by its own rebellious officers. And in fact, the Nazi Reich did end decisively and completely and instantly when Hitler committed suicide in the bunker. So in many ways, the more the leader is representative and the sort of sustaining force of the body politic as a whole, the more certain his decapitation will change things. Now, in the case of Mr. Putin, I think the West has this wrong. And by the West, I mean simply the Anglosphere and NATO, and perhaps Japan and South Korea, but it's not the whole world by any means. And the idea that killing the Tsar will somehow lead to sweetness and light, and more to the point, a groveling and submissive Russian state and people is wrong. The Russian people are behind their Tsar, and in fact, they are increasingly feeling aggrieved that they have been so beleaguered at Western aggression. And I say aggression with some temperance here, because it is not a simple-minded sort of attack on Russia, but it is a force that has been unleashed by the fall of the Soviet Union, and that developed and continued in the 1990s all the way to the present, and has sought the reduction of Russia into a kind of submissive slave status, not esclavos in the sense of, you know, the defeated armies will be taken by Romans into actual slavery, but a kind of complete submission where Russian identity as a great power, a kind of exceptional civilization, will be taken away, will be reduced and eliminated from their consciousness. This is not that dissimilar from the goal, say, of the Nazi Reich to destroy Poland or Russia in the 1940s. It's something that goes back in time, to our time in the period of the first century AD. And I think this is something that Americans, being completely wrapped up in their own religious zeal, that we are the only true word of God, that God has given his agency to America to redeem humanity and uplift it in the image of democracy as we define it. We are so wrapped up in that kind of religious sensibility that we cannot imagine that other civilizations, with their own vision of their own exceptional character, would cavil at that and would respond by resisting to their utmost, even to their death, in order to not submit to the United States. And I think we're coming up to that now, and because we can't see it, this is an extraordinarily dangerous moment in our national life. We're coming face to face, I can only put it as the ultimate downside of what made us strong now makes us not only weak, but fated. In other words, it was wonderful in World War II that our zeal led to the complete defeat of the Nazi enemy and Japan. But today, our relentless, unyielding pursuit of our vision of truth is leading us to a global calamity that we are unwilling to realize that the fruits of our intemperate force will be potentially our own destruction, in a nuclear holocaust at its worst, but at its best, the destruction potentially of the world order that we created and have benefited from so bounteously these last 80 years.
Let's talk about American exceptionalism, because that is the driver here for remarks by the president and his counselors about the war in Eurasia, this war very far from us, that you have to spend several paragraphs explaining why America's involved at all. This is Germanicus, Michael Vlahos. I'm Gaius, John Batchelor. We're in Londinium, being philosophical. And when we come back, Roman exceptionalism is easy for us. We understand. We are the might of Rome. American exceptionalism, however, turns out to have a couple of twists when we return with the Friends of History Debating Society.